Hey folks, welcome back to another episode of the Inside Winemaking Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Duane, and I'm excited to have a new sponsor for the podcast, and that is Hanna Instruments. So back during Harvest 2017, my pH meter cut out, and I began researching other possibilities for new equipment and came across what's called Edge pH meter from Hanna and ordered one, and I've been so pleased with it that I reached out to Hanna and asked them to if they'd be interested to sponsor the podcast. So while Hanna carries a full suite of lab equipment, especially pH meters and stuff for TAs, PHs, even with some auto titrators, that kind of cool stuff, this is mostly going to be focused on Edge, which is a really nice basic pH meter. So this thing is a sexy, sleek tablet interface design, well-suited to chaotic wine lab environment, even has hardware to wall mount the tablet display, which I did get it on the wall up away from splashing grapes and other chemicals. It's got a quick startup and two-point calibration. You can work with as little as one-point calibration if you're a cowboy, but I just use the basic 7 and 3 pH buffers, which gets me quickly into the measurement mode for pH. The resolution is to the hundredths of a pH unit. It's easy to set up and log data. It's got lots of customizable options for calibration and data recording. Edge can also be used for DO, it's dissolved oxygen, and conductivity measurement. The easy swap out of plug-in probes, and Edge automatically recognizes each probe. I'm saying Edge because they told me not to say the Edge. I'm supposed to write it in lowercase letters. So, Edge is incredibly thin, weighs only 8.8 ounces, has 8 hours of battery life and dual USB ports for charging the battery. It's got a large LCD display for geezers like me. I really like this so I can see my pH results from across the room. Edge can be used in extended or basic modes. Extended mode enables all features available, while the basic mode, or what I call Jimbo mode, reduces the amount of features to a very simple operation. For me, this is really critical. I'm mostly using the pH meter during grape maturity sampling and harvest when I want to get results quickly. I want accurate results, but I don't want to spend a whole lot of time with equipment. Edge has been really helpful in that regard. It's got built-in temperature compensation, USB ports for charging, and 8 hours of battery life. Comes with a 2-year warranty on the instrument and 6 months on the probe. Free shipping. And includes certified pH buffers, electrode storage solution, and specialized cleaning solution for wine deposits. I recommend getting the whole package so you get the stir plate and everything. It took me about 10 minutes to set up, and I was going really pleased with this instrument. Hanna also sent me what they call a Halo, which is a neat little wireless pH meter. So this is a little handheld pH probe that connects over Bluetooth to your phone so you can use in the cellar. So I've been playing around with that a little bit and really impressed with the speed, the ease of use, the accuracy of the results. And I think that can be great for use in small wineries, home wineries, and anywhere where people want to take pH measurements quickly outside of the wine lab. Okay, so thank you to Hanna for sponsoring the podcast. You can find websites and links to Edge at insidewinemaking.com and show notes for this page. Also, you can check out Hanna, HANNAINST.com, or you can just search Hanna and Edge. I'm sure it'll pop up. Really great machine. Thank you to them for sponsoring. So on to today's podcast. This is something that's been a long time coming. Those of you who've listened to podcast through the fall, I think the late summer and fall of 2017, recall that I started what was called the winemaking chemistry series. And I had a podcast about sugar and alcohol. It's been one of the most popular podcasts. I've received a lot of positive feedback on that with people asking for more. The reason I don't put out more of these chemistry podcasts is just that they're more difficult for me to put together. Anyway, I appreciate the positive feedback. I will try to put out more. If anyone has suggestions or ideas of other chemistry topics they'd like me to cover, I will either cover that myself or do what I did today and go out and find people that are more qualified than myself to talk about the subjects. So I went out and asked my friend Dave Nakaji to help me with this podcast about pH and TA. Dave is the winemaker at Sebastiani Vineyards and Winery over in Sonoma. He's also one of the smartest people I know, has a PhD in organic chemistry, but most importantly, has the ability to take complex subjects and make them available and accessible to normal people, and was especially helpful in translating how he uses pH and TA all through the whole winemaking process. We ended up talking for so long and going into Dave's background that what I'm going to do is cut his interview up into two pieces. So the next episode is just going to be Dave's entire episode where we talk about a lot more winemaking than just pH and TA. But as we did spend about the second half of his episode talking about pH and TA, I've cut that out for this podcast so it can be more focused on chemistry specifically. So that's going to be the first half of the podcast. And then the second half is me having a discussion with a woman from Hannah Instruments named Casey Bannock, who is very helpful and replied to my request for some general tips on taking care of a pH meter. Casey gave some guidelines that could be helpful, very useful for any pH meter, not just those from Hannah Instruments. And so I think there's some helpful stuff there in taking care of the equipment so you have long-term, accurate, precise measurements, because pH is such a central key to all of winemaking. So here we go. We're going to start out with Dave Nakaji from Sebastiani, and we will finish with Casey Bannock. You can find all show notes at insidewinemaking.com. Here we go.
Everybody talks about acidity, right? So important. Preserve acidity. Mm-hmm. And like, oh, well, in France, they never had tartaric acid. And it's like, well, yeah, it's because they don't need to, mm-hmm. right? Their season is so much different. They pick at pHs and TAs that we see when the grapes are still green in Napa. I've worked with vineyards that have disease issues or soil issues, where as you get towards ripeness, the pH will skyrocket, TA will collapse, and you'll bring grapes in and the pH is over 4, the TA is in the 3s, and I've brought in grapes once where the pH was 4, the TA was 4, and the malate was 3.
Oh, Jesus.
And it's like,
it almost seems impossible.
Right. Yeah. I'm like, so there's no acid left, and half the malate's going to go away when it goes through malolactic. And early in my career, I was very nervous about adding acid. And, you destroy the terroir, whatever. And I was very hesitant. And now I just adjust the pH. I don't care what the TA is. Adjust the pH. So if it's 4, I'm going to bring it down to 3.6.
We're talking specific grapes here? Reds?
For reds.
Yeah, well, whites aren't going to be that high.
Whites are never that high. Right. No. Okay. Whites, I mean, even really horrible Chardonnay was still 3.7.
Right. 3.8. I mean. Okay, so we're talking about reds.
Yeah.
Keep going.
But anyway, whatever it is, like, yeah. And
so
and
you're more pH focused than TA.
100% pH
focused. Okay.
I don't care what the TA is. And there was a point where I would hesitate, but I have added 5.5 grams per liter tartaric.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just
makes me sweat.
I one time added 4 grams tartaric to a funky Pinot vineyard. And after adding 4 grams tartaric, at the end of fermentation, malolactic, like 3 months into aging, it was at 3.9 pH and a TA of like 4.4. It was like, I really should have added more. And after that, I was like, I'm just going for the pH number. I don't
care. Okay, so you have a target number in your mind?
Yep.
pH, what is that?
3.63.
Okay, why? 3.6, that's very specific. It's under 3.65.
So 3.65 is a magic number.
Right, okay, why?
We'll talk about that. Yeah, yeah. So I'll say, pH is a buffer. And it's a very difficult concept, but molecules in equilibrium, so tartaric is a diacid, right? It has two protons it can give up, and bitartrate in equilibrium is 3.65. And if you're above 3.65, when your salt crashes out, you'll go up in pH. Mm-hmm. And if you're below 3.65, when your salt crashes out, your pH will go down.
Salt crashing out is a function of like cold stabilization, right?
Cold stabilization, alcohol. So you start out as a water solution, water sugar solution, and you go to an alcohol water solution. Alcohol is not as good a solvent as right. water. So all those ionic things like acids will precipitate mm-hmm. and they'll fall out of solids. And, you know, as maybe not everyone knows, but that's what the crystals in your bottle are.
Right.
And
so as that precipitation happens, where, correct me if I'm wrong, where you are relative to pH 3.65 dictates whether your pH will go up or down during that precipitation.
Right.
So above 3.65, precipitation will lead to an increase in pH, vice versa, down.
Right. So if you're below 3.65, it'll go down. And if you go down, your wine's more stable.
Microbiologically.
Yep. Okay. It's more microbiologically stable. It ages better. Mm-hmm. You don't taste pH.
Right.
You taste TA.
Well, some critics don't agree, but I'm with you.
Yeah. Right.
People in the trenches know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, if you've done the, I mean, Ann Noble had that, right. You know, you tasted the same wine at 3 pHs and 3 TAs, mm-hmm. and you taste the TA, right. You taste the totalous acid, but you don't taste the pH. You can, if you adjust with a real acid, a strong acid, you can't tell. I mean, it'd be great if the TTB would allow you to adjust with sulfuric acid, because, man, that'll change your pH like nothing.
So does it like make you cringe when wine writers talk about this tastes like a high pH wine?
Oh yeah, I can barely stand to read that stuff. The science is so weak.
Yeah,
it's frightening. Yeah, and, you know, but that's,
you got to live in two worlds.
You have to live in two worlds. It's not their fault. I mean. Right. They're writers. If I could write that well, I'd be writing too. You know, I mean, unfortunately, I can't. I sound like a petulant child when I write.
Okay, so why 3.63?
Just to give yourself a little wiggle room.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you want to err on the side of physical stability, microbiological stability.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And
so you're just adjusting juice.
Yep.
Down? Okay. So yep. Right away, post-harvest, that first sample.
Yep.
Okay.
You get those grapes in for reds. I cold soak 24 hours. Take the juice. Test it. Mm-hmm. See where you're at. Hit it.
Can you formulaically know that, or is that something you have to do by trial lot per lot?
You know, ideally, If we're not busy, we'll actually do the buffer trial. So we'll do different acid adjustments and see where we actually hit, like, okay, we'll take the juice, add a certain amount of acid and see where we get. Otherwise, we'll just do it like, you know, we'll probably do the buffer trial for the first 2 or 3 weeks of harvest, and then we'll get too busy, and then we'll just. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, every vineyard is different, but yet within a season, there are certain trends.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
You know, like, some years the buffer capacity is really high. There's some years where you can add a ton of acid and you barely move the pH. And then some years, like, you add a little acid, it's like, whoa.
Right.
And so we'll kind of use that to, like, oh, you know, this year we don't, yeah. So we'll adjust our, it's not a pure formula. It's like, whoa, you know, shoot high or low.
So I appreciate your honesty in talking about this, because not everyone is as comfortable in talking about it. Are you ever in a situation where you have to kind of be in a defensive position about this?
Not yet.
I mean, not here.
This probably after this. Yeah.
No, but this is a technical show. Okay. Well, that's fair.
I don't know. My background's in science, so I'm not comfortable lying to people. I'll skirt around the truth, but I'm not gonna lie to people.
So is there, how does TA, if it does, play into your decision making? And let's focus on kind of grapes and early harvest winemaking stuff. Are you looking at the TA at all in white grapes, white juice? You don't give a shit.
No.
Okay.
No, and you know, I mean, like, this year was a very, I mean,
2017
was a very strange year. That heat spike at Labor Day, like, that was brutal.
I mean, we all sampled grapes. We saw high sugars, freaked out, picked. Everyone brought in grapes to the winery and said, holy shit, like, it's 2 bricks lower than the sample.
Yeah.
I heard that across the board.
Yeah.
Assume it's the same case.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I had stuff where our field sample came in at 24, 25 bricks, and we crushed it. I mean, I literally had something that sampled at 24 bricks, and it crushed at 19.
Jesus.
And it's like, I have 12% wine, and luckily it was a huge vineyard, and it's like, we're gonna stop picking. And we're not going to add any water or anything to the second half of this vineyard, because we need to get the alcohol up. Well, you know, like, we cannot sell 11% wine. Plus, the label would be wrong.
Right. Okay, so do you even look at TA? Are you having
it? Oh, I look at it. Yeah, sure.
And for why? Is it just mental fodder?
Yeah, curiosity and and try to get a I think it gives you a better idea of what the health of the vineyard is.
Okay.
If the TA is out of balance, you're more likely to have a problematic fermentation. You know, those are the things you keep an eye on. Like if you get something where the pH and TA are out of balance, you're more likely to have something where all the nutrients are out of balance, and that's a fermentation that's going to stick. And so, like, you see that, and you're going to keep an eye on that tank, and when you see your Brix curve flatten out at some, you know, unfortunate number, you're going to be like, okay, we're going to throw Uberferm in it, or we're going to do something. We're going to get on that tank right away.
So more specifically, what is acidity out of balance? We're talking high pH, high TA. What does that balance look like?
High pH, high TA is the obvious one. Sometimes you'll see that's the biggest thing. This year we had stuff where we had ridiculously high TAs and low pHs. And but then they, I mean, they crashed out, and it's just
the TA crashed out?
Yeah.
So then it came down to something reasonable. Yeah. So kind of like it's a problem that went away.
Yeah, it was a problem. Yeah, it was a problem that went away. And I mean, I had, well, actually I had stuff with high pH, high TA. That was the weird thing this year. So I had stuff where the pH was not high, but like 3.75, right? You have a pH 3.75. Which is like, normally you'd do like a tiny acid add and get it down. But the TA was like 10. Wow. And you tasted it. Tasted 10.
So super sour.
Yeah. But the pH is high, right? 3.75 is above my magic number. And, you know, people, enologists come up to me and I'm like, well, should I add acids? Look at the TA. No, add acid.
Okay, so you are unwavering from your magic number.
Well, it took me to the breaking point. Like, you know, you're like through fermentation and you're, you know, you got your pH is sitting at 3.5 and your TA is at 9.5 and you're just like, oh God, this is going to be undrinkable. And it just tastes horrible. And then, you know, it went through ML. Mm-hmm. The tank ended up coated with crystals. And we're at 3.63. And the TA is at 6.256. Oh, it worked. So far, nothing's right. Ended up like...
And it isn't the case, like, if you have... Okay, say imagine you have a really high TA,
right,
and a low pH, so you're super hesitant to add acid, or you don't add acid, but that I think there's almost like a super saturation of those organic acids.
Oh, absolutely.
When you have 9 and 10 grams per liter that you're reading as TA, we're like, that's not going to...
It won't stay.
With the alcohol, it won't stay.
Right, it won't stay. Yeah, right. Absolutely. Right. Yeah, that's the magic of chemistry, right? It's like those acids will not stay in solution. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true. You taste TA, not pH.
Right.
I mean, to us, like, yeah, if you took it down to 1.
Yeah.
But it will crash out. There's no force on earth that will overcome the magic of chemistry.
Right.
And... Yeah, it's just it's chemistry and physics. It's gonna drop the TA out, and you're gonna be okay. That's all there is to it.
So let's get just a little bit more granular with white wines specifically. Make some Sauvignon Blanc, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's kind of an ideal pH and TA for Sauvignon Blanc? Both as juice, starting juice, and then as finished wine?
For me, I like it between, for Sauvignon Blanc, 3.1 and 3.3. Don't.
It's a picket.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
As grapes.
As grapes. Mm-hmm. Pick it early.
Don't give a shit about the TA, I imagine?
No. Okay. It all kind of... If you pick it early enough, it all comes together better. And for Sauvignon Blanc, actually, I mostly pick on flavor, just because there's that window where the flavor and aromas are at their peak. And for a wine like Sauvignon Blanc, you are depending on those grape-based flavors.
Yeah.
So Chardonnay... you know, a lot of what people think of as Chardonnay flavors are actually yeast flavors, barrel flavors. They're not actually, you know, Chardonnay itself is actually pretty bland.
Right. It's the most boring juice on earth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's always, to me, that's the amazing thing about good Chardonnay vineyards, it's like, oh yeah, there actually is a Chardonnay flavor, you know, but you don't taste it as a juice, right? You don't. Like, you have to work with a Chardonnay vineyard for a couple of years, and you're like, that is a good one. That's a good one.
At this point now, the most important cue I use for picking Chardonnay is look at this, the color of the grapes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm obviously watching sugar and acidity and the canopy and the leaves, but that change into the golden,
right.
You know, from green to golden, like a little bit of brown, like, When my interns start telling me, like, oh, hey, the grapes are starting to look a little bit brown and golden, a little bit weird, like, okay, good. We're coming into the window. we're getting real close to picking.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's not Sauvignon Blanc. It's not going to be bright green.
Right.
We need to move into that a little bit and, like, watch other parameters. But in a good year, like, that's the most major cue for me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's...
Well, and it tastes the grape, but the grape's not going to say to me, like, it's no explosion of flavor. It's Chardonnay.
Right. Yeah, like Sauvignon Blanc, when that, if you're going to hit that window, you're going to taste that grape, and you're going to, like, for me, literally, you taste it, and I go, it's not quite ready. I'm calling my vineyard manager to pick it, because it's going to be, you know, because he's going to tell me, oh, I can't be there in 3 days. It's going to be 5. It's like, perfect.
Right.
And if I'm tasting it and it's like, oh, it's ready, it's like, shit, I missed it. Because he's not going to be out there, right? Mm-hmm. He's got other stuff to do. And yeah, exactly. But with Chardonnay, yeah, definitely. It's like, well, I don't know. It tastes like Chardonnay.
Still boring,
yeah. But it does. It's like it drives me nuts because... Like, it all tastes the same in the vineyard, but then the good vineyards, they, as they age, they're just like... They separate, yeah. It's like, wow, this is angular and bitter and thin and without a lot of, like, maybe has some green apple. Mm-hmm. And then the good ones are like, wow, this is, like, all rich and exciting. And what a pain in the ass. How am I supposed to know when to pick this stuff?
Okay, so PHTA for Chardonnay, what's kind of ideal ranges for grapes?
You know, I'm the
that's
same
a,
way.
That's a bigger range.
It's a much bigger. I do stick to my formula for adjusting the juice. I try to get Chardonnay juice down to 3.5. Lower than pH. Any reds, yeah. Just to, I want it to still be able to go through ML, but not, you know, but for as far as picking, it's totally based on color and ripeness. Yeah, I want the berries to get that slightly soft character.
And I imagine you have end target alcohol ranges.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, some of the stuff we do, we want to be under 14. I tried to pick those earlier just because you don't want to add water.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that over, though, now that the tox classes are no longer an issue at 14%?
I think so. It'd be nice to just pick stuff based on ripeness. I mean, you know, in California... We have so much sun. Now, I said this earlier tonight before we were on speaker, but it's like people in France, they never add acid because that destroys the terroir. It's like, yeah, but I've watched somebody add a pallet of sugar to a tank. Like, does that destroy the terroir?
Doesn't count.
Doesn't count. It's like... I have never added sugar to a California wine, believe it or not. I mean, it's just not something we do. It's because it destroys the terroir. But we add acid. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know? I don't know if it would really change that much anyway, picking decisions. I still try to I still try to get everything right. We're not big enough that I have to pick on a schedule yet.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully we never get that big.
Oh, and so what for someone making wine on a really small scale, what does that mean? How does schedule play into size and logistics?
Well, so I do 5,000 tons a year. My winery can hold 1,500 tons of grapes. So I need to get just over 3 turns on every tank. Mm-hmm. If my early grapes, this year was a perfect example. My early grapes were ready right at that heat spike. They all came in a week because of the heat.
This is late August 17?
Right at Labor Day.
Yeah.
Right? So I filled up the winery, but then after the heat spike, it was pretty mild, yeah, right?
Right.
And so then we actually got...
And everyone's freaking out because everything came in lower sugar than expected.
Yeah. But we got everything out of the winery and...
No, not out of the winery, but through the...
Through the fermenters.
Right.
And then it's like, well, what do we bring in next? And the next, that heat spike did weird things to some varietals. Like Merlot was just, I've never seen anything like it, but Merlot stopped accumulating sugar for me. All my Merlot vineyards like just pegged at whatever they were during the heat spike.
And so they, physiologically, they were really
messed up. Yeah, they were messed up. Mm-hmm. And like Cabernet ended up fine, but Cabernet doesn't ripen until October, and so the stuff I would normally bring in mid to late September didn't ripen. And finally it was just like, wow, we have to start picking some stuff, because starting October 1st I have Cabernet that's gonna start coming in. I have to be sure I have enough room. And so that's what big winery is.
Like. And okay, with Cabernet, how quickly are you going to get it from Dave Harvest processing out of the fermenter?
We're not any different than, I'm not trying to make a huge Cabernet.
Yeah.
Sebastiani style has always been sort of a softer, sort of ready to drink. So I don't want to do extended skin contact. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to, 2 weeks max.
Okay. So press in barrels or either aging tanks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's 2 weeks, right?
So, yeah.
So if I'm going to do 3,000 tons of Cabernet, I need... need to get stuff in, get stuff out.
Okay. How much of your job do you consider to be logistics during that harvest period of time? I mean, are you the main person managing inventory of grapes, tanks, space, people?
Yeah.
So that's a
huge part of it.
That's a job in itself outside of anything enological.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. You have to be on top of all that. That was the amazing thing about the tour is that certain tanks were like, oh, this is the tank the Von Romanet goes in. I'm like, what? Well, what if it comes in big? I'm like, oh no. It'll fit. Really? And Burgundy, they actually have limits on how much a vineyard is allowed to produce. Mm-hmm. And so we occasionally would just like saignée into the drain. Like, because a couple of the vineyards came in heavy. Like, what? Well, it's above the legal limit. It's like, what? Like, this is like, $12,000 a ton grapes, and we're saying yang into the drain? Like, I shouldn't even be saying this.
It's okay.
Yeah, you know, it's like, okay.
Burgundians have a long history of nefarious.
So. Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. There won't
be any news. Oh, no.
But, you know, yeah, so for us, it's like, yeah, you have to just balance it out, like tank space. And you know, we're always like, we can only press so fast anyway, so we have to just kind of always be thinking a week ahead.
Right. I love that part of the job. It's one of my favorite parts. Let's go back to PH&T a little bit and talk about finished wine. Mm-hmm. So we're talking post malolactic fermentation for all red wines. Obviously, Sauvignon Blanc, you're not going to have Malo. Chardonnay, you're going to have some skew of Malo. What sorts of pHs and TAs are you interested or hoping for? Or so for like, let's stick with Chardonnay, because I know you make quite a bit of Chardonnay.
Right.
What do you want to see with pHs and TAs?
You know, that. That's,
what ranges do you like?
For finished wine, I mean, that's why I'm so aggressive about getting the juice. So, like, I don't think you can adjust a final wine's pH or TA in a significant amount without ruining it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've added, I think my record now is, it might be 6 grams a liter of tartaric. I'm not sure. It's in that range, right?
Yeah.
For a finished wine, I've never added more than 0.2.
Okay.
Because you can't do anything at that point. It just tastes terrible. You can't do it.
Did you taste sourness? Like, what do you taste?
Yeah, it tastes okay. Sourness. It brings out angularity. It brings out bitterness. Mm-hmm. The wine's no longer at equilibrium. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing is like, you know.
So timing is more important than anything.
Yeah, timing is huge. Timing is huge. Yeah. Finished wine, it is what it is. You've created it. It has to stand on its own. I mean, I'm not saying I never adjust a finished wine, but it's like, you know.
Tweaky. Tweaky.
Yeah, it's sprinkling powdered sugar on a donut. It's mm-hmm. not, you're not changing the batter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. It just doesn't work.
Have you ever had to add potassium carbonate to bring pH up or TA down? I've done this in the past at some prior jobs, and it's been a disaster, honestly. Like, you do the trials in the lab, pick a rate, and then you do it in the cellar, and it way overshoots what your trial was in the lab. Your pH crashes, it goes up way more than expected, the TA goes down. I remember this lot of Sauvignon Blanc 10 years ago at a different winery where I was not making these calls, but the winemaker was not happy with how high the TA was. You would have been totally comfortable with it. TA was high, so we added acid. And gauge went low. Well, if the TA was high, we added potassium carbonate.
Mm.
So pH came up, TA came down, went too far. We ended up having to add acid later. So we overcorrected, then overcorrected again. Like, you know, and as a winemaker, every time you do that, you feel like, I'm just taking a little bit of the soul out of the wine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in the end, like, if we would have left it alone, it would have been just fine.
Right.
And I've done some late in the life of wine potassium carbonate additions to Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
And one, you got to be careful because that precipitation is super slow. So if you do it near bottling, you're going to get a bunch of sludge in the bottle, which is not okay.
Right.
But again, it's also the same. The lab benchtop trials were not truly indicative of what we saw in the cellar. And it was an overshoot in the cellar.
Right.
I don't touch potassium carbonate anymore.
Yeah. I try to never. Yeah, for the same reason.
Are you concerned with how pH affects microbiological stability?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I think that's the biggest reason to keep your pH in control is once you start getting above 3.7, like SO2 loses its effectiveness, you're just asking for your wine to age poorly. I mean, something's going to happen to it. And, you know, marketing people would just love for every wine to be sold and drunk within the year it's bottled. But the reality is, I mean, especially at a place like you're at,
yeah,
where your wines are expected to age. Mm-hmm. If you put something in the bottle at 4, the odds that it...
It's a risk.
It's a risk. Is it going to make it to 5 years? Is it going to make it to 10 years? I mean, there was a great tasting of cane wines. And, like, you know, they're famous for having Brett.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, some of the wines tasted great. And they had high Brett levels. And some of the wines tasted horrible. And they had actually lower Brett levels than some of the other wines. And it was just like, I don't think that's a gamble I want to take, you know? And I want my wines. If we have a bad sales year, I want my wines to taste 2 years out better than they tasted when they went into the market. And I think that's the easiest lever to pull to control that, you know?
What's the master lever, right?
I think that is the master lever, right? Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's like, yeah, that's the easiest thing you control. pH, boom. No matter what you put in the bottle, get your pH right. You know, red wines, white wines can be a little lower, but still, otherwise you're just rolling them down.
Okay. Let's wrap it up with two things. One, tell me what your childhood smelled like. San Diego.
Ocean. My dad was a resident, so he was basically a student. And my mom would just, you know, she didn't work. Well, she did work her ass off because she had a bunch of boys in the house. And she would just like, all right, we're going to the beach. And back then there were no child seat regulations. So there'd be 3 kids in the back of the station wagons, 3 in the back seat, 1 in the front seat. And we'd take the whole neighborhood down to the beach and we would just play in the ocean all day. And that was my childhood. That was freaking awesome. Like, I don't know. You couldn't do, you'd take like a whole caravan now. I mean, we would literally get 7 kids from the neighborhood down to the beach on a Saturday in 1 station wagon.
Okay. You made wines in Burgundy, in Australia. If you could have a couple tons to make anywhere in the world, what would you want to make?
You know, I've listened to your podcast, so I've heard this question many times. I thought about it.
So you should have a really awesome answer.
Yeah, you know, and I thought I would, but I don't. And one of the things that's always...
If I stop you there, I would think you'd be the least likely person ever to listen to this podcast.
Really?
Yeah, that's the compliment of the week. Yeah, okay, thanks.
No, I like your podcast. It's actually... There's a few that have been difficult for me, but mostly they've been... They're always entertaining and interesting. I think, if I could... do it. When I worked in Burgundy, it always drove me nuts because we would go out and do vineyard work in Vin Romanée, and Louis Tour owned a big chunk of Romanée Saint-Vivant. And literally 3 yards away across the road was Romanée La Romanée. And Romanée Saint-Vivant was a 80-year-old bottle at the time, and Romanée Conti was 600-year-old bottle, and now it's like a 3,000-year-old bottle. And they're literally meters apart. And I would just love to take a ton from each and like do them side by side. Like, is it really? Can it be that different? Like, what happens in the 3 meters across this freaking road? And do that. I mean, it always like, you know?
And you have to have a lot of money to understand those wines, right? I mean, because like...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry. Anyway, all right.
Let's wrap it up. Anything else we need to talk about before we should talk about before we wrap this up?
Okay, tell me best way to find Sebastiani, website stuff or whatever.
Yeah, we're at, you know, Sebastiani.com.
That's easy. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else that I didn't ask you that you think we should talk about before we knock it out?
No, I thought we were going to talk more about pH and TA. I like, reread my chemistry books in case you're going to ask me something tricky.
You know, I've thought about the question, you know, like I've wanted to try and, in building this podcast, which I've been doing since July, which is 7 months, I thought about defining what pH is, and it's such a fucking boring definition.
It is.
Like, I just imagine 9 out of 10 people falling off a wagon trying to listen to it. Like, you need to know how to use it, when it's important, why it's important.
It's a number.
But like protons and log.
Absolutely. Like, I agree. And I'm a chemist. And I was just like, yeah, it's boring. It is. It's boring. It's like,
right.
It's a number. You should know what the number means.
You should understand that it's logarithmic. That's super important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think enough people appreciate that. It's not.
That's true. We should have talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Logarithmic.
It's logarithmic. There you go. Now you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the fact that, you know, a wine at a pH of 3 and a wine at a pH of 4, it's a factor of 10 because it's a log. So it's not 1, it's 10, which is a lot.
So maybe I'll do a later solo podcast just talking about pH because I think that factors in SO2. Like I need to talk about pH and SO2. That's a big one.
Right.
A lot of people have a hard time getting a handle on that, and that's super important. So anyway, that'll be another one. We're done. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next segment in this episode will feature Casey Bannock from Hanna Instruments. I took her up on her offer to come on and talk about care and maintenance of pH meters. Well, we talked specifically about some of the instrumentation from Hanna. A lot of these principles can be applied to any wine pH meter. Here we go. But okay. We're gone. So I want to start off with one question that I had. So when I was going through the materials on the Hanna website, looking at the edge specifically, it was talking about a pH range from negative 2 to 16.
Yep.
Totally confused because when I went to school, pH went from 0 to 14. What's the story there?
So if you have a really, really strong acid, and sometimes people will do a relative pH. So if you're measuring pH in a solution that is not aqueous, if there's no water in it, if it's an alcohol or something, it doesn't follow the real pH range.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. All right. So thank you for that. So one of the things, the main thing I want to cover today is management of pH electrodes, some of the best practices. I'm really going to let you lead this, but where's the best place to start for beginning new with the pH electrode system from Hanna?
Okay, so the best thing is always make sure it's hydrated. So sometimes when it ships, it could leak out, or if you take one off of a shelf that you haven't used in a while, you want to make sure your electrode is hydrated. It has a layer on the outside is what communicates with the sample, and if that dries out, you don't get a good response. So as it gets hydrated in your sample, even though you calibrated, it's going to change the way the electrode responds, so that pH 7 you calibrated to when it was dry is no longer pH 7 when it's wet.
Okay, so would you know if it's, is there anything in the instrumentation that's going to tell you if it's become dry and it's not measuring as accurately?
It depends on the instrument you have. Okay. Some instruments will do a cal check, and they can tell you this buffer from last time you calibrated is reacting really different, or your electrode is reacting really different. So it'll tell you to clean your electrode, or it will tell you to check your buffers. make sure they're not expired or contaminated.
Okay. And would the Edge be one of those instruments that can do that?
Yes, the Edge, so it has a condition and a response feature on it. So you would be able to see how it's responding and how what the condition of the electrode is. And then it actually has a message that says bad buffer or clean electrode if something is off in your calibration.
Okay. Do you want to talk about cleaning now, or do you want to continue talking about hydration and all that? Does that cover hydration?
That pretty much covers hydration.
So basically, you just always want to keep it in the little sleeve.
Yep, right? With the storage solution.
Storage solution. Is that silver chloride?
Potassium chloride.
Potassium chloride.
Yeah, okay. So it matches the internal electrolyte so that it will continue to respond and you don't have osmosis where it becomes less concentrated inside and no longer responds the same.
Okay. Now, is there the probe, because I haven't looked at it in detail yet, the one that I received, is it open to the air, or is it fully sealed?
It has a sleeve junction, so there's a little Teflon piece on it that kind of looks like a ground glass if you look at it from a distance. You can slide that down, and then in there is one hole that is
exposed. Okay, that's what you showed me.
Yep.
Okay, but for the folks listening, go ahead and continue describing. Right.
So, yeah, there is a tiny pinhole. With that sleeve down, it's not exposed to the air, but there is some communication. Mm-hmm. If you slide that sleeve off, you'll lose all your electrolyte because it is a very open connection.
Okay. And does a user need to be replacing that at any point in time?
If you see a slower response, I would recommend changing the electrolyte. If it starts to deplete below a quarter of an inch from the top of the electrode, I would add some. You don't necessarily have to change it.
Okay. How do you add it? Just do that tiny little hole?
Yep, there's a tiny little screw on the top, and it comes with a pipette with a tiny tip, so you can refill it right there.
Gotcha. And is the storage solution, that potassium chloride, different from the internal probe solution?
It's a little bit different. I'm not exactly sure. They don't release the exact concentration.
So a user shouldn't be just going and getting potassium chloride. They would want the proprietary stuff, I assume?
So for the internal electrolyte, we do say it's 3.5 molar, so that is something you could make. But the storage solution, as long as it's a concentrated salt, of course, we want you to buy ours, but we're not going to make you.
Okay. All right, cool. So what's next? Then let's talk about cleaning the process for cleaning the probe.
Yeah. So there's two different cleaning solutions that we offer, one for deposits and one for stains. Both would be used the same way. 15 minutes in the cleaning solution and then rehydrate it at least for an hour in the storage solution, ideally overnight.
Okay. So just you immerse it in the cleaning solution.
Yep.
Do you want it mixing with like a spin?
It doesn't need to be. Okay. It can just sit there.
Is that an enzymatic reaction, or how is it cleaning?
One of them is a very concentrated acid, and I don't think the other one's an enzyme. I forget what it is.
Okay. So cleaning, then rehydrate in your storage solution.
Yep.
Okay, cool. And then is that something where people just need to look at the probe and visually decide when it needs cleaning?
Visually, or also if you notice it's responding a lot slower, or if when you calibrate your slope and offset, which we can go over, is if that has changed, you might want to clean it as well.
Okay. Let's talk about slope and offset. And if you wouldn't mind define those for me and everyone else listening, so don't know what that means.
No problem.
It's been a long time since I was in school.
So for the slope and the offset, it's you would use two pH buffers, 4 and 7, 7 and 10. You want to use pH 7. What the millivolt reading at pH 7, that is considered your offset. In pure water, in pH 7 buffer, you have as much positive and negative, so your millivolts in a perfect world would be 0.
Okay.
So you want to be as close to 0 as possible. We recommend plus or minus 30 millivolts for a functioning electrode.
Okay.
If you come outside of that range, it's probably time to start cleaning your electrode.
Okay, so you're in your
pH 7 buffer.
Buffer pH 7, and if it's above or below 30 millivolts, then it's time to fix something.
Yep.
Okay.
On the Edge, you just press range button, and that switches it, so you can see the millivolt reading.
Okay. And then that would tell you you need to clean.
Yep.
Okay. Cool.
For offset, you're looking at the difference from each pH unit. Mm-hmm. For slope, that was offset. For slope, you're looking at the change. So every pH unit you change, it should be a 59.16 millivolt change.
Okay.
So from pH 7 to 4, it's about 160, 180 millivolts. So when you read the pH 4 buffer, you write down your millivolts, and we can calculate what your percentage would be.
Okay. And then...
the Edge does this for you every time you calibrate.
Okay. And will it, it'll give you a readout of your slope as like a, something...
percent.
Approaching 1?
Yeah.
100%?
Yeah, so we would say between 85 and 105% is a good working electrode.
You know what? That's... I wish someone would have told me that years ago, because I've always seen these numbers after I do my calibration. Like, well, okay, that's what it is. I don't. I have no idea like what was good or bad or out of working range.
Yep.
So 85 to 105.
Yep. Okay. And then again, if that is out of range, then check your buffers and possibly clean your electrode.
Okay. Check buffers. And as I got, I would assume when you sell the Edge kit, that comes with a couple of buffers. When you're selling it to wineries, it would be specific to wineries, probably the pH 7, pH 3 or 4 buffers?
It's pH 3, yep.
Okay.
So then you would just add the extra millivolts, but the Edge will calculate it for you.
Okay, cool. And then, this is kind of an aside, but could you go over what all comes in the Edge kit when you get more than just the probe itself?
Yep. So you get the Edge, you get the stand for a benchtop.
I'm sorry, I'm going to cut you off real quick. Tell me what the Edge is. So it's a probe, right? pH probe with the...
tablet-style meter. Yep.
Which is really sleek and nice. I like that.
It is pretty. And it's very durable. I actually got to push it off my desk a couple times when we were trying it out.
On purpose?
Yeah, the owner said, do what you don't want our customers to do.
Oh, okay. So, and it survived?
It did.
Cool. All right, go ahead. So Edge, tablet, and then...
Yeah, so it's the Edge tablet-style meter. It has... it's kind of like a headphone jack where you can plug the pH electrode in. And then you get the stand for the benchtop. You get a wall mount in case you'd rather have it there. Both stands can charge it. Mm-hmm. You get a stir plate and a stir bar. You get pH 3, pH 7. You get a cleaning solution. And you get a storage solution with it.
Okay. And then is it just plug and play if I wanted to, say, get like a DO probe or a conductivity probe?
Yep. The Edge will recognize what probe you have in and automatically switch to that mode so you can't accidentally calibrate the wrong parameter.
So the DO probe is something I'm really interested in. Is there anything else a user would need to know to be able to use the DO probe? Any other best practices?
So it comes with a couple of the membranes. They're user replaceable. If you tear it or if you let it store for a long time, you should probably change them.
What's a long time?
Over 6 months.
Okay.
And then you have an electrolyte in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest thing people don't realize is there's a temperature sensor. It's a little silver circle. Make sure that's submerged to get accurate readings.
Okay. Okay. And this may be a silly question, but would that work only in a liquid solution then? You said it's got to be submerged?
Yeah. Only. You could do a slurry if you had a soil or something that you wanted to measure. Just add some water.
But a winemaker couldn't drop this over the top of the tank in the airspace to measure the
DO. No, in the air it wouldn't work.
Okay. Cool.
It'll give you 100%, probably.
Or what is full saturation of oxygen? It's like 8.9 milligrams per liter in wine, usually?
Yep.
Okay. Most wineries won't, I tend to use the DO probe at bottling, and I want to be below 1 milligram per liter. It depends what wine I'm bottling. Okay, and then for a conductivity meter, any other special things with that guy?
You would need the calibration solutions, and that one's really easy to maintain. There's no electrolytes. That probe, basically you buy the probe and only calibration solutions. There's no maintenance for it.
Okay. Do you sell a lot of those, or is it people mostly just for wineries focused on pH?
Mostly pH. DO, a lot more than EC. The conductivity is probably the smallest one that we see people ask about.
Okay. And then what else do we need to talk about for usage or care of the probes and unit?
For calibration, we recommend daily. Not everybody does that.
Does that mean once daily I can just turn it on and calibrate in the morning and generally be okay?
Yep, because the probe actually stores your calibration. So if you switch from pH to DO and then go back to pH, that calibration is saved in the probe.
Okay. So what happens overnight such that the calibration is no longer as accurate the next day?
They tend to drift over time. Some people don't. They'll just check a pH 7 buffer, and if it's within a certain percent, they'll use it.
Mm-hmm.
But good practice for reporting is always calibrate daily.
Okay. And then Real quick, if you could just go through the calibration process.
Yep.
I appreciate that.
No problem. For the edge, it's just a cal button right on the front. You press that, it will prompt you what pH it wants, and you can do 7 or 3 first, and then you do usually 7.
Right.
And then after it is stable, a little CFM will pop up for confirm. You press that, clean it off with DI water or distilled water, and go into your next pH buffer. And once that one is stable, you can confirm that and hit cal again to escape. Mm-hmm. And your slope and offset are immediately displayed on the bottom of the screen.
Okay. And then hopefully you would be in that 85 to 105% range, and then you're good to go for measurement, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it goes right into measurement mode.
Okay. If someone, say a large winery during harvest, had hundreds of samples in a day, is there anything you would recommend to do to take care of the machine?
I would possibly check a pH 7 buffer or a pH 3 buffer occasionally to make sure it hasn't drifted, something hasn't built up on the electrode, it hasn't dried out in between samples. Maybe every couple hours, check one.
Okay. And anything else we need to talk about the edge? I want to talk about the halo in a minute, but...
For the edge, not really. It's just a really nifty unit.
Right. And are people seeing those last for a long time?
Yeah, they're definitely very durable. The electrodes are generally 18 months to 24 months they'll last with proper care.
And then you just, at that point, you just gotta buy a new electrode, right?
Yep.
Okay. Electrodes. Okay, so let's talk about the Halo, because I have yet to play with the one you guys sent me, but I saw on the show floor where you were going through that. That was kind of cool. Could you talk about what that is?
Yeah, so that's the world's first Bluetooth electrode.
Cool.
It's a Bluetooth pH electrode. It can pair with a phone or a tablet, Apple and Galaxy functionality. You have all your pH readings right there. It takes a reading every minute. You can calibrate just like you would any other pH meter. Save it. You can annotate different readings, send them to yourself, or keep them on your phone. It's just really portable. It's a great way to move around from, you know, tank to tank, barrel to barrel, and not have to carry everything with you.
Right. Is that probe essentially the same probe as for the edge?
Yep. It's okay. The same probe, except the calibration is not stored in that probe. It's stored in the app.
Right. So. Okay. This is a dumb question. I apologize.
That might be wrong. Sorry.
It's okay. For Bluetooth, you have to have wireless in order to have Bluetooth. Is that right?
That part might be beyond me.
Okay.
I just know as long as you have the Bluetooth connection, I don't think you need the wireless.
Okay.
Because I turn it off on my phone. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so you just have to stay within a certain range to your
phone. Yeah, like 30 feet or so.
Okay. Oh, I ask because that'd be important for like me. Like I'm in a cave where I'm not going to have wireless, obviously.
Yeah, lots of concrete and steel.
Right. Cool. All right, anything else on the Halo? This seemed like a really simple...
Yeah, it's really easy to use. It has a watch battery in the back, so you can replace it. The app is free. So you just download the Halo Lab app and then pair the electrode to it.
All right, cool. Anything else we need to talk about with maintenance, calibration, or
I don't think
care?
So. Just always store your electrode in liquid,
okay.
In storage solution, not
storage
DI
solution.
Water.
Right.
DI water is not good for it.
And if you... Okay, no, I've already covered that. All right. I think we covered everything I wanted to go through. Anything else?
No, I think that's good.
Cool. Thanks for doing this.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you to our show sponsor, Hanna Instruments. Check them out at hannainst.com. That's hannainst.com. You can also just search for Edge and Hanna and find their Edge pH wine meter. Also, I'll have links on the episode URL. That can all be found at insidewinemaking.com. I recommend checking out the Edge and Halo wine pH meters. These tools are purpose-built for winery environments. The Edge wine pH meter is rich in features, including using digital electrodes that can be swapped out anytime to switch to a different parameter, such as dissolved oxygen or conductivity. It has built-in rechargeable battery, 2 USB ports, data logging, automatic calibration, and Hanna's exclusive calibration check feature that will alert the user to potential problems during calibration, including when to clean the probe and when the buffer might be contaminated. The Edge Wine pH Meter is a versatile pH meter for winemaking that can be used as a benchtop, portable, and even wall mount to conserve space. This next episode I have coming up will be the full interview with Dave Nakaji. So stay tuned for that. Should be out within a week or so. Please hit me up if you have any questions or comments about the show. Jim@insidewinemaking.com. All right, we'll catch you later.